Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So a survey came out a few years ago that said that 1 in 3 American adults are pervasively dissatisfied with their lives. Research has also shown that if you're born after 1970, you're 7 times more likely to have depression than those who were born before 1970. 1 in 4 of Americans have some sort of addiction, whether substance or behavior. We're drowning in record personal and public debt. And the crazy thing is, we live in one of the most affluent times in our country's history, safest periods in our country's history. So, I mean, everything is awesome, but a lot of people are feeling really miserable. Why is that? Well, our guest today wrote a book, and we wanted to find out the answer to that. His name is Jim Rubens. He is a New Hampshire politician as well as businessman, and his book is called Over Success: Healing the American Obsession with Wealth, Fame, Power, and Perfection. And in this book, Mr. Rubin makes the argument that the reason why everyone's so miserable is that we're pursuing material success at all costs. It's the thing we put up before anything else, as well as fame and notoriety. And he makes the case that's making us miserable. And he gets into sociological research, psychological research, neuroscience that shows that our obsession with success, and he calls this obsession with success over success, is making us feel terrible. So it's a fascinating discussion. I think you're really going to like what we talk about today. It's sort of a balance. A lot of times on the podcast, we talk about how to be more successful. I think his book provides a warning if you get too crazy with that. So without further ado, Jim Rubens, Over Success. All right, Jim Rubens, welcome to the show.
And it is a pleasure being here.
All right, so your book is Over Success, and I encountered this book by accident at the library a few years ago, and for some reason, I was drawn to it, checked it out, and really was amazed by the content and the argument you make. And you basically make the argument that there's a disease, quote-unquote, and you call it over-success, and it affects Westerners, but primarily Americans. What are the symptoms of over-success?
Well, I guess I'll launch right into start with what's natural and healthy and good for human beings. We're unique among the species on Earth. We're a species that is very, very good at working with one another in groups. And we have done amazing things over the past 10,000 years because of our ability to form groups and to transmit knowledge and cultural behaviors, healthy cultural behaviors, from generation to generation. And we've basically gone from a blip on the species radar screen 60,000 years ago to basically dominating the Earth today. And there's a reason for that, and it's the healthy parts of success. And what's the healthy part is that we all, as individuals, want to have internal satisfaction from producing something of value, of being recognized by people who are close to us, of attaining personal goals, achieving altruism, or mastering something difficult. And in doing those things, often, and this is a healthy thing, we seek to attain recognition and satisfaction from a pat on the back from other people who are close to us. And those motivations, that motivation to do that for the good of our group, for the good of our community, if you want to call it a community, has led to this extraordinary progress that humans have made, particularly in America over the past 200 some odd years. We've doubled the human lifespan, for example. We've created food abundance so that there's very few of us in America ever need to even be concerned about having enough warmth in our homes or food in our bellies. It's not universally true, but we've eliminated hunger and starvation in a remarkable way. Now, the unhealthy, what I call oversuccess and obsession, and the title of the book, The Oversuccessed, Healing the American Obsession with Wealth, Fame, Power, and Perfection, the unhealthy part of it is due in part to the change in the world, the changes in the world we live in. And unhealthy success or oversuccess is when people are pathologically pursuing unattainable goals or fixated on unattainable goals, or more wealth, fame, power, and perfection or beauty than can be obtained by ordinary people. So healthy success, doing things for personal satisfaction, improving life in your group, mastering something, unhealthy success, a pathological pursuit of unattainable goals, whatever they might be.
Have you experienced oversuccess in your own life? Was that what caused you to start investigating this and doing the research about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, human beings are all different. We vary on various scales of behaviors and personal goals and attributes. And myself, I had early in my adulthood, I decided to live a very simple life without being motivated much by materialism. So I did most of what I did for altruistic reasons. And I started, it was my first business. I've started about 10 businesses in my life since then. My first business was started purely out of altruism. I wanted to have recycling in my area of the country, in Vermont and New Hampshire. And there was no recycling. I called the EPA, asked them, how do you start a recycling center? They said, it cannot be done where you are. So that stimulated the heck out of me. I'm a business person and I love entrepreneurship. So I figured out a way to make recycling happen. In about 3 months, we were recycling about 5% of the entire solid waste stream of 30 towns around a town that I started this in. I did so in a shoestring and built it into a very successful business almost instantly. And about a year and a half later, I sold the business because a conventional rubbish hauler had seen this can be done, wanted the branding of recycling. And so I sold the business and I was hitchhiking back in a November day. This is the introductory paragraph in my book. I was hitchhiking back in a cold November day. It was spitting snow and I was cold. I was dressed in Goodwill clothing and I looked like a bum on the side of the road because that's the way I dressed. I was not into materialism any kind, and I couldn't get a ride because I didn't believe in having a car, and I could not get a ride back to my house a few miles away. And I decided I watched all the gleaming new cars come by with working heaters and well-dressed people inside, and decided that my voluntary simplicity lifestyle was too painful for me. So I switched sides and I became an entrepreneur. And I started a number of businesses, and I discovered that no matter how successful I was at doing things, at getting money, at getting recognition, at accomplishing stuff, that there was in me, and this is my psychology, I discovered there were these unmet needs that no matter what I did, no matter how high I set my goals, and no matter how well I achieved them, I was always wanting. I always wanted more. So I began researching this, and it led to 5 years of research that resulted in the book. And I don't claim or state that every American is subject to these motivations, but I have found, this is the research in the book, that about a third of Americans, due to human nature, the human body, the human brain, and what's unique about America, the United States of America, makes about a third of us susceptible to this set of problems and challenges I had in my own life. So yes, this book came out of my personal experience.
So you call it oversuccess sort of a pathological drive for success. But what happens when you have that pathological drive? Does it lead to depression, addiction, alcohol? I mean, what are the ills that come with being so driven for recognition, money, material goods?
Well, one of the things that comes out of failing to achieve goals for yourself that are unattainable, the pathological pursuit of unattainable goals, one of the things that come out of that is you poison your brain's reward system. I'll explain that in a moment. And it's possible that one, in doing this, can become depressed, and one can degrade one's own life. I'll start with a little bit of brain science. We have a reward system in our brain. All creatures that move have a reward system, and it's been changed by evolution over the millennia. Even single-celled creatures that crawl have a reward system that directs them to things that are good or likely to be good for that creature, and directs them away from things that are not good or likely not to be good for that creature. Your reward system looks at this whole panoply of things that you can do for yourself, whether it's getting some more sex, getting more money, getting more food, doing something exciting, doing something novel. All of these things drive human behavior, and this reward system sorts through all these exposures that we have and helps us determine automatically which of these things we're going to pursue. And this reward system operates, and this is a bit oversimplified, but this reward system in our brain terminates in part in this part of our brain called the nucleus accumbens. And the last stage of the reward system is a surge in release of dopamine in the brain, which is picked up by five different receptors in this area of the brain that determine for us what direction we should go in and how rewarding a behavior is expected to be. Now, we can poison that reward system. Some people poison it through addictions. Some people are prone to addiction. About a quarter of Americans are addicted to at least one substance or behavior. When you're addicted to a substance or behavior, you begin seeking out that substance or behavior, and it culminates in a fanatic desire to do nothing but get more money or get more of that substance or that behavior. And over time, you poison the reward system, diminishing its response to pleasurable or likely to be pleasurable activities or inputs, so making you less sensitive to rewarding things. So another thing that can poison the reward system, because human beings are rewarded by attention. It's very clear that same part of the reward system that lights up and dopamine is released with the expectation of having good sex or having a wonderful meal or a stimulating experience or something novel and exciting, being recognized and viewed by others is rewarding to that same portions of that same reward system. So if one is frustrated in getting these rewards, particularly the attention reward, the status reward that I talk about in the book, over time, the brain's reward system is poisoned, making it less susceptible to naturally occurring rewards.
The status research was just fascinating to me, because you also relate to how it relates to problems that men are facing today. What's the dopamine, or is it not dopamine, it's serotonin, right? It's the neurotransmitter.
Yeah, that's a different neurotransmitter, and I didn't spend a lot of time exploring that in the book, and I don't intend this book to be a brain science book, but I wanted to explore just a portion of the reward pathway to show that the science up to the time I was working on this book was showing you the reward system can be injured by addictions, by frustration in one's effort to reach unattainable goals, and in what I call status insults or status deceit.
Yeah.
So, for example, they've researched rats and mice. If you take a mouse, a low status mouse, and all mammals have an inherent status rank. If you put mice in a group, they'll sort out, there'll be dominant mice and subordinate mice. And if you take a subordinate mouse, a naturally occurring subordinate mouse, and put it in a cage with a dominant mouse for 10 minutes a day, once a day, and the dominant mouse elicits certain behaviors in the subordinate mouse, if you do that for 10 minutes a day, the subordinate mouse, after approximately a week or two, scientists call that mouse defeated. The mouse will switch its behavior pattern to become more likely to hide in corners, less likely to engage in the swim test, where it would swim across some water to get food or to get to a different location in a cage. So mice and human beings can be defeated by excessive exposure to status superiors, or be socially defeated or suffer status defeat by failing to achieve goals, again, unattainable goals, or being under-recognized, underappreciated. This gets into politically controversial territory, but men and women are different. We can look at our bodies. We have different bodies. And it follows, and it's been proven to be so by science, and again, it's politically incorrect to talk about this, but men and women have different brains and different psychological functions. And bottom line, men are more sensitive to status defeat, as I've described it, than women. If you look at, and I'll, this is some data about, this is about 8 weeks after conception, a male boy, 8 weeks after conception, the body is flooded with testosterone at about twice the levels that a boy is exposed to during adolescence. And it alters the structure of brain development as the child is growing. And you can see differences in boys and girls even before they can possibly have any sexual role models imprinted upon them. Boys, young boys, very, very young, attention and gaze is directed at machines. Men and boys are interested in systems and machines. Girls are attracted, and this is girls very young, before any kind of sexual imprinting could possibly take place. Science has shown this to be the case. The girls will look at faces. So girls are good at reading faces, at social interaction. Males, boys, are good at systems thinking, good at building stuff. The body is, the male body is bigger. The male was built over time. The male has, in almost every case, been primarily engaged in warfare. So if you look at current data, this grows out of the difference between the male and the female brains. If you look at men, they're more prone to drug addiction for pleasure. There's about 2 to 3 times greater drug addiction prevalence among males than females. It's about 4 times for alcohol. The male brains have more of those dopamine receptor neurons than female brains. So all of this, and it's a lengthy chapter in this book, but all of this leads to the male brain being more reward sensitive, more sensitive to rank and status, more sensitive to rank and status, relative rank and status in the world.
I think you even mentioned how they've done tests where they'll expose men and women to status defeats. They'll create some sort of experiment where they do that. And the women, they don't really have much of a response. But in the men, like, cortisol floods the body. There's parts of the brain that light up that don't light up in women's bodies. So, yeah, like you're saying, that the men are, I guess, wired for being very, very sensitive to status.
To status defeat. No, this is not to say that men and women are all men are one way and all women, sure, are the other way. This is a spectrum of behaviors across, but it's more likely that a male will be more sensitive to status defeat, more sensitive to his rank within his group or society than a typical female. But there can be females that are more sensitive to status, rank, more interested in power relationships than males. So these are tendencies across the spectrum of human behavior. But it does lead to men, as I mentioned, being more sensitive to status failure, to status defeat. And we've also seen changes in America that has aggravated this. And we'll keep talking about males here versus females. Before about 1970 in America, after World War II, the male was typically the breadwinner. We had a lot of jobs for breadwinners. You had typically the male would go out and work and be able to support an entire family. Now, since that time, in the past 40 years, the bottom 80% of men, and this is by income, the bottom 80% of men have seen their wages decline as we've shifted from labor to professions demanding intelligence and social skills. And yet women over this past 40 years have seen their incomes go up 33%. Now there has been a disparity between wages between men and women. In the 1970s, that gap is closing. But this is fairly recent data. Over the past 10 years, if you have a man and a woman never married, no children, in their 30s to 40s, they now earn about the same amount. The wage gap is closed between the sexes in America for never married, childless men and women. So men have seen their income status drop. This is the bottom 80% of men by income, and women go up due to the changes in our economy. So males have less of the traditional awards that have come with those breadwinner roles as the economy has changed. So number one, men are inherently more sensitive to questions, and the economy has aggravated this problem uniquely for men. And it doesn't mean that women are not affected by this, but just on average, across the whole spectrum of behavior and people, these changes have been, in general, more adverse for men. The shift from a manufacturing economy to an intelligence and social skills-based economy.
It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code manliness to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code manliness. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness. rocketmoney.com/manliness. Spring is here and the McKays are going to be really busy. I'm coaching flag football again. My daughter's playing basketball. And on those nights when we don't have time to cook a full meal and clean up, we like to eat Factor meals. Factor meals are ready-to-eat meals that are on the table in less than 2 minutes. They're fresh, they're not frozen, they're chef-crafted and dietitian-approved. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You just simply heat and savor the good stuff. And all these meals are really, really nutritious. They're macro-friendly if you're tracking your macros. That's another reason why I like them. So we've been using Factor meals for a while. One thing I've enjoyed lately is the green chili chicken. Super tasty. I also like the creamy mushroom chicken and rice. Very good. It also comes with garlic green beans. And again, you just warm these things up in 2 minutes, and then you have this really delicious meal. And best of all, cleanup's a breeze. If you want to try this out, head to factormeals.com/manliness50 and use code manliness50, that's manliness50, to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's a good deal. That's code manliness50, manliness50 at factormeals.com/manliness50. Get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Well, you've served in public office and you've run for public office. And
yeah.
How does this shift where men are no longer breadwinners, will that have long-term implications for our society and our country as a whole?
Definitely so. When the women's movement really began in my younger part of my life in the 70s, society was called upon and did and is paying attention to problems unique to women. And it's really at the point now where we have to begin paying serious attention to problems that are unique to men. And we can see data showing how serious this is for, if you look at data related to white, not in school, young men between, say, 18 and 24. If you look at this data, you see this spike over the past 20 years, 20 and 30 years, in rootless, disconnected men who don't have specific roles in the economy or society. They're hanging out, not being productive, not fulfilling themselves. And this stems from the change in the kind of jobs available, the kind of economy we have right now. And it's important for policymakers, and myself, when I was in office, I was attuned to this as much as I could, the need to pay policy attention to these questions. It relates to, if you look at data in higher education, you see women pushing 60% of college attendees now, and college graduates are now females compared to men. So we have to pay attention to the need to shift the way our education system works with men versus women as one thing that needs to be done.
Yeah, I was a few months ago, I was talking to a relationship expert who had her PhD, and she, you know, claimed to be a feminist. She called herself a feminist, and she even said that this shift that's happening, it's really disrupting marriage, because while they're advancing in the workplace, they would still rather prefer to marry a man who makes more money than them. That's what the statistics are showing. But when more and more men are doing worse in the workplace, there are fewer and fewer eligible bachelors, so to speak. And this could have long-term implications on a lot of things on a societal level when it comes to things like our welfare, you know, welfare system, which is based on us continuing to have children. And if we have a decrease in demographics, that can affect a whole wide range of things.
Right. It's very well known that you know, healthy families need a man and a woman, a husband and wife. I'm fine with gay marriage, so it could be two men, but typically it'll be a husband and wife rearing a child. And because we're having this growing population of young loser men, and what I mean by losers is people who are not in school, not productively employed, it's a growing fraction of young white men fall into this category, and women who are seeking to sustain a healthy role in the economy are not attracted to an economic loser. And it is causing that is one component of the cause of a delay and a reduction in initial marriages. And that's not healthy for society. As you mentioned, you need to have babies born in a country. So there's a natural flow from young to old. And so we don't run into the problem that Japan is happening, where you have this rapidly aging population with young people not wanting to form families. with women not wanting to marry men, and young people not being born.
Yeah. So you talk about how oversuccess is this pathological drive for unattainable goals, which raises the question, how did we get these unattainable goals, right? Like, why do we have these unattainable goals now? Was there a time in our right. country's history where we had a little bit more modesty about what we were capable of accomplishing, or did something happen where the limits became, you know, pretty much endless for what we could achieve in life?
Yeah, there has been a change. And again, this is in one measure caused by the kind of media that forms the groups that we inhabit psychologically. If you look back through human history, this is going back to hunter-gatherers and up until fairly recently, the average group that we inhabited, the people we related to these people face to face. These groups were stable. They could be a tribe, hunter-gatherer tribe. They could be a village in classic New England. But the people with whom we related, we knew for our entire life. Those relationships were stable. People had a very good sense of one another's roles. And in these smaller groups, that number in the dozens or small number of hundreds, in these smaller groups, everyone, regardless of their capacity, almost everyone had some kind of role that was valuable for the group. They did something. Group hierarchies were selected, again, face-to-face, often in small groups like this. Leaders are selected by consensus from the bottom up, as opposed to being imposed by a boss from above. And as society changed, and as we moved away from small groups, the group that we now inhabit, and this is partly due to globalization, in large measure it's due to the kind of media that we spend hours looking at. The average American spends 8 hours a day looking at screens. People still spend 4 hours a day looking at television. Retired people in America are pushing over 8 hours a day watching TV. We're now inhabiting a psychological group in the billions. I estimate the number being 2 billion as the people on the earth who inhabit this world, where we spend hours a day looking at people who are more beautiful, richer, more famous, more talented than we are. And not only that, when these people are on television or on media, they often have a battery of publicists and digital retouch artists, making them even more perfect than they actually are. So the people with whom and against whom we compare ourselves in order to determine our rank, we're no longer looking at a small group that might be a village or a tribe. We're looking at the brightest, the most famous, the most successful, the most talented, the most well-trained people that the earth can produce. And the human beings have become phenomenal at attaining remarkable. Look at the women's soccer team that just won here for America. The extent of training and selection that members of that team go through to get to that point is phenomenal. So the sorting process, the sifting and sorting process that we go through in America to select our most recognized people is more intense than it has been throughout most of human history, most of human evolutionary history. So we're comparing ourselves to people that we can't possibly emulate if we're realistic about it. And this causes to some people who this is not everyone, but that fraction of human beings and Americans who are sensitive to this, it causes some of us who are sensitive to this to suffer status defeat simply as a result of being forced to compare ourselves to people like that. And you see this in the checkout counter as you're walking through your supermarket. Look at the covers of the tabloids. Look at typically the people you see. They're gorgeous, they're famous, they're rich, they're successful. Why can't I be like that?
I was going to ask you, when was Oversuccess originally published?
2009, early 2009.
This was before like the big social media explosion. And I think that like with Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, for example, I think may have just compounded what you just talked about, even made it more acute and more intense.
Yeah, well, Facebook was certainly around at that time, and I spend time talking about it. People who apologists for the system say, well, Facebook groups and communities are a good substitute for face-to-face communities, and that is absolutely not true. Anyone who participates in Facebook, it's easy to enter, it's easy to exit. You may never see that person face-to-face. The reputations of people, their trustworthiness is determined, is sometimes undeterminable. Healthy human communities in which ordinary people have roles that are satisfying and satisfy their need for status, their need for recognition. These groups typically, if you look throughout human history, these groups typically are in the range of 100 or 200 people. And you are with members of that group for your entire lifetime. So you know who can be trusted, you know who's good and who's not so good at various tasks. And also, as I mentioned, there are roles for almost everyone in that group, valuable, valued roles for almost everyone. So Facebook and social media is not a substitute for long-term, stable, face-to-face relationships.
I'm curious if there's any connection to some of these mass shootings that we've had in our country. Because one thing I've noticed, you know, they're usually males, always men who do this.
Yeah.
And one thing I've always noticed, they typically write a manifesto of some sort before they take part, and they'll explain why they're doing this. And oftentimes it's just filled with just writings about how they feel like they're not respected and that people aren't respecting the way they think they should be respected. And then after they do this, then they will be known and be respected and get the respect are entitled to. Is status defeat connected somehow to that, or are they two completely different issues?
I attempt to make that case in the book. Now my data ended in about 2007, 2008. But if you look at, and this is still true today, males are responsible for at least 80% of all violent crimes. The question has to be asked, why is it that it's almost always males perpetrating these things? And again, it comes back to my thesis that males are simply more status sensitive. They're more sensitive to status insults than females. It's not that females are not subjected to these pressures. 80% of females in America don't like their own bodies as a result of this media pressure. That females are put under these unattainable goals to have this idealized, quote-unquote, perfect body. So females are also subjected to this pressure, but the female brain responds differently to this kind of status insult than the male brain does.
So what are the solutions? Because whenever these sort of shootings happen or whatever the travesty happens or whatever we talk about, there's always sort of these trite responses about, well, the men just need to get used to this new system. Is that the appropriate response, or is there something else that we should do to handle this?
Absolutely not. If we're talking about school shootings, first of all, I don't believe that taking guns away will help anything. I'm myself back arming a trained and certified individual in schools, and we've seen that these acts of school violence can be mitigated, reduced, and nipped in the bud earlier when there is a trained person in the school. But there are clearly things we need to do to help. And again, it's primarily young boys who are subjected to status defeat, often as a result of bullying. It could be, and it's often boys that have B's and A's in their grades. It's not that they're not smart. It's boys that might look or behave odd. And we need to be very, very careful about stopping bullying and finding places where help can be given to people before this kind of violence erupts. I advocate in my book that we ought to be ramping up single-sex schools. And it should be by choice. A parent should not be obligated to send their boy to an all-boys school. But there are about 500 in the U.S. now. We can see that properly managed, because boys learn differently than girls. This is, again, politically incorrect to say that, but boys are experiential, tangible learners. They're spatial learners. In general, this is not true of everyone. Girls learn better in the classroom where you sit down and hear lectures. Just the brains are different on average. And again, I'm avoiding being politically incorrect here. This doesn't apply to every girl and every boy, but there should be a greater use of single sex schools for parents who wish their child to be in such schools. That'd be one solution. Dealing with bullying, very, very important. Very important that peers, if you look at these studies at the school violence, you see that in many, many cases, 80% of cases, a peer, someone who knew the perpetrator, knew the precise features of the violence plan before it was executed. Schools should pay very great attention to encouraging peers to report these things to the teacher or to the school leaders, and the school leaders acting in a humane way with people who might have such a plan or a plot in mind.
Besides some of these big policy ideas that we can do to mitigate status defeat and oversuccess, what about like just an individual's own life? And maybe there's someone who's out there listening where they feel like they're just frustrated. They don't feel like they're at the amount of success or the level of success that they should have. Are there things that individuals can do that sort of can take the kind of blunt the effects of oversuccess?
Yeah, absolutely. The last chapter of my book has about 20 things that we can do. About half of them are things that individuals can do. The simplest and the first of my bullet points, the first of the 20, is that people in America and throughout the world, but in America here, we ought to start being polite and responsive to one another. When we're walking down the street, nod and smile at the person. Complete stranger, you may never see them again, but nod and smile at that person. You will brighten that person's day. You could change that person's life in a particular time. Hold the door for someone. Don't be obnoxious about it. If someone is within a few, 5 or 10 steps of where you're, hold the door open for them, regardless of how old or young or what sex they are. Hold the door for them. Be kind. Say please. Say thank you. Chivalrous. I see that on your Art of Manliness website, the renewal of male chivalrous roles. But both sexes ought to do this. And again, what this does, it creates a warm place for people, possibly in a moment in their lives when they need this, that can make a difference. Another thing we can do that is personal, and this is for ourselves: be rational about the goals that we set for ourselves. Be rational about the goals you select for yourself. I use the 50% rule. Select goals that you're about 50% likely to attain in your life. You don't want to select goals that are impossible. If you're not good at running, don't try to become an Olympic runner. It's just going to frustrate you. Select goals where you have the talents, the aptitudes, the social networks that are feasible in your own life, and don't perpetually set goals that are impossible for yourself. 30% of American teenagers think they're going to become famous someday, and they literally structure their lives, and Facebook is a culprit here, about trying to become famous on Facebook or by some other means. That's not a realistic goal. So that's something that an individual can do. Set rational goals for yourself. Something that's more structural that individuals can participate in, I call them new villages. And again, I talked about the natural evolutionary adaptiveness of human beings to small, stable groups where we know one another and we are with one another face-to-face over long periods of time, and we form durable relationships. We know one another to the extent to know who's good at what, who's not so good at what, and roles are found in such groups for everyone. I call them new villages, and we can install these new villages in our workplaces and in our communities. We ought to be working very hard in America at finding alternatives to these mass-scale organizations composed of millions of people where only 1 or 2 or 10 people can be recognized. A company I like to, and I point this one out in my book, a company called W.L. Gore, they make Gore-Tex. They're a large company with several thousand employees, but they break their work groups into not greater than 150 or 200 people. When a work group making a particular product or service gets bigger than that, they have a corporate policy to break the group down. They literally build buildings that are sized to hold only 200 or so people, and they build new buildings and break groups down into new work groups when they get bigger than that. And they do that specifically so that people know one another. And in each work group, leaders of that group are selected bottom-up by consensus. People bid for the opportunity to lead work groups in W. L. Gore based upon their ability to sell themselves to other people, to their peers in their work group. So you can structure a large, and this is a very profitable private organization, W. L. Gore, but they've structured their corporate organization around the natural human tendency to want to thrive and be recognized in groups that are small enough so that almost everyone in that group can be recognized for something. So another thing that I speak about in the book, have friendships. The number of Americans who have zero friends, and this is good social science data, has been cut in half over the past 30 years. About a quarter of Americans report having no friends whatsoever. So friendships are one of the most highly important things. Obviously, loving relationships are important, but friendships, durable, long-range friendships where you can share deep stuff, very, very important to human lives. We've got to spend a lot more attention on this. And instead of looking to get a bigger car, a bigger house, a bigger boat, a prettier face, think about getting a friend or two. So there's some examples of things that we can do individually.
Fantastic. Well, Jim Rubens, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Thank you for having me. Very, very appreciative of this question.
Our guest today was Jim Rubens. He's the author of the book Over Success, Healing the American Obsession with Wealth, Fame, Power, and Perfection. You can find that on Amazon.com. Go out and get it. It's a really fascinating read. You'll get a lot out of it. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And again, if you enjoy this podcast, you feel like you're getting something out of it, I'd really appreciate it if you'd go give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. A lot of you have done that for me. I really appreciate it. Your feedback will help us improve the site, and you giving your review will help spread the word about the Art of Manliness podcast. So until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.